Early on, Cruz and Miscavige shared a powerful sense of identity with each other. They were both short but powerfully built, East Coast personalities, as Parman diagnosed them. They shared a love of motorcycles, cars, and adventurous sports. Miscavige was bedazzled by the glamour surrounding the star, who introduced him to a social set outside of Scientology, a world Miscavige knew little about. He had spent most of his life cloistered in the Sea Org. He was thrilled when he visited Cruz on the set of Days of Thunder, and the actor took him skydiving for the first time. Cruz, for his part, fell under the spell of Miscavige's commanding personality. He modeled his determined naval officer hero in A Few Good Men on Miscavige, a fact that the church leader liked to brag about. Just before Christmas 1990, Sinar Parman was told that Tom and Nicole were going to get married and that he and a Sea Org pastry chef, along with their wives, would be cooking for the wedding party. Parman was assured that they would get paid for their trouble. In the meantime, they should buy some civilian clothes suitable for a cold climate. Parman went shopping and put everything on his credit card, along with a Christmas present for Cruz. Then Cruz's private jet flew them to Telluride, Colorado, where the wedding took place. They spent 3 days preparing meals for guests. Cruz's auditor, Ray Mithoff, performed the ceremony, and David Miscavige served as best man. Afterward, Parman was informed that Miscavige had changed his mind about paying for his services and the expenses incurred. Parman was left with hundreds of dollars charged to his credit card, which he struggled to pay off on his Sea Org salary, $50 a week at the time. At first, Tom and Nicole seemed like the ideal Scientology power match. They were intelligent, articulate, extraordinarily attractive people. At Gold Base, Tom reached OT3. He would have spent a considerable amount of time after that self-auditing in order to exercise his body thetans. Although Nicole didn't share Tom's obvious enthusiasm for Scientology, she was a cooler personality in any case, she was drawn along by his intensity. She went clear in no time. Within a year, she had reached OT2, but then mysteriously stopped. A candidate who has begun the OT levels is not supposed to pause until OT3 has been achieved. Miscavige suspected the influence of a suppressive person, specifically Kidman's father, Anthony Kidman, a clinical psychologist who had written several popular self-help books in Australia. From the beginning, Kidman was privately considered a potential trouble source. One day at Gold Base, Marty Rathbun summoned a 16-year-old Sea Org member, Mark Headley, and told him that he had been selected to undergo special auditing. He was to tell no one about it, including his co-workers and his family. And by the way, the auditor would be Tom Cruise. Headley reported to a large conference room. Right away, he noticed Nicole Kidman, who was also receiving auditing, and Kirstie Alley, who he later came to believe was there mainly as a celebrity prop, since she did little other than read. "Hello, I am Tom," Headley remembers Cruz saying, vigorously shaking his hand. Footnote: Cruz, through his attorney, says he has no recollection of meeting Mark Headley. Bruce Hines, who was there to make sure the process was done correctly, witnessed the sessions and clearly remembers Cruz auditing Headley. End footnote. He handed Headley the metal cans that were attached to the E-meter and asked if the temperature in the room was all right. Then he instructed Headley to take a deep breath and let it out. This was a metabolism test, which is supposed to show whether the pre-clear was prepared for the session. Apparently, the needle on the E-meter didn't fall sufficiently. Headley was so starstruck that he was having trouble focusing. "Did you get enough sleep?" Cruz asked. "Yeah." "Did you get enough to eat?" "Yeah." "Did you take your vitamins?" Headley said he never took vitamins. "That might be the problem," Cruz said. He went into the pantry, which was filled with snacks for the celebrities. Hedley was used to the meager Sea Org fare, and he was taken aback by the cornucopia laid out for the stars to nibble on. As Cruz rummaged through the cabinets, Hedley bit into a cheese Danish. The actor found several vitamins and then asked, "Do you take a lot of bee pollen?" Hedley had no idea what he meant. "Never had bee pollen?" Cruz said excitedly. "Oh, that will do the trick for sure." He led Hedley to his Yamaha motorcycle and rode the two of them to the base canteen. It was dinner time, and the canteen was filled with Hedley's gawking co-workers. Hedley was surprised to learn that there was bee pollen for sale, although he says Cruz didn't pay for it. He just grabbed it, and they went back to the conference room. This time, Hedley passed the metabolism test, although he privately credited the Danish over the bee pollen. According to Hedley, Cruz helped him through the upper indoctrination training routines. "Look at the wall," Cruz would have said, according to Hubbard's specifications. "Thank you." "Walk over to the wall." "Thank you." "Touch the wall." "Thank you." The purpose of this exercise, according to Hubbard, is to assert control over the pre-clear and increase the pre-clear's havingness. Cruz went on to ask Hedley to make an object, such as a desk, hold still, or become more solid. Another exercise involved telling an ashtray to stand up, at which point the pre-clear stands and lifts the ashtray, thanks the ashtray, and then commands the ashtray to sit down. With each repetition, the pre-clear's commands get louder, so soon he is yelling at the ashtray at the top of his voice. The purpose of this drill is to come to the realization that your intention is separate from your words and the sound waves that carry them. These procedures went on for hours as Hedley robotically responded to Cruz's commands. You learn that if you don't do what they say, they'll just ask the same questions 5 million times, Hedley recalled. At one point, he fell asleep, but he kept responding automatically. This training went on for hours every day for several weeks until Tom and Nicole returned to Hollywood. When Nicole moved into Tom's mansion in Pacific Palisades, they were under constant watch. Miscavige's wife, Shelley, interviewed Scientology candidates for Tom and Nicole's household staff. According to former executives, the Scientologists who worked for Cruz and Kidman reported to the church about whatever they observed. Miscavige offered the couple significant gifts of service from Sea Org members. They installed a sophisticated audiovisual system. Sinar Parman, the chef, says he helped design the kitchen. There was a comfortable, symbiotic relationship between the star and the church. The use of unpaid church clergy to help him renovate his house, hire his staff, and install sophisticated technology was simply a part of the deal. Footnote: Cruz's attorney remarks, "So far as I know, Mr. Cruz has always paid for any services he received." End footnote. Paul Haggis was always a workaholic, and as his career took off, he spent even less time with his family. He wouldn't get home till late at night or early in the morning. His three daughters scarcely knew who he was. In general, Haggis was far more interested in causes than people. He drove an environmentally friendly car, a little yellow Mini Cooper, with a "War is not the answer" bumper sticker. The Haggis house became a regular stop for the social justice sector of the Hollywood left. Once, when Haggis threw a fundraiser for Tibet, the Dalai Lama came. The backyard was strewn with celebrities and chanting monks. The girls thought it was hysterical. Barbara Streisand introduced herself to the Dalai Lama, and he asked what she did. "A little singing, a little dancing," she told him. For years, Paul and Diane's marriage had been in turmoil, and in 1983 they began an epic and bitter divorce. The proceedings lasted for 9 years. The girls lived with Diane, visiting Paul every other weekend. During this period of estrangement from his wife, Haggis flew to New York with a casting director who was also a Scientologist. They shared a kiss. He later confessed the incident during an auditing session and was sent to the ethics office, where he was assigned some minor punishment. He had been to ethics before, usually for missing coursework, but he was beginning to feel that the more famous he became, the less likely he was to be rebuked for behavior that was considered out ethics for other members. Anytime Haggis boggled at an illogical or fanciful piece of data, he was invariably reminded that it was his failure entirely. He had come into Scientology as an adult, so his experience outside the church still informed his judgments. When he stumbled on something in Scientology that he thought was ridiculous, he would make a mental detour around it, not wanting to spend the time and money to do the repairs that his supervisors would prescribe. Although he never lost his skepticism, his daughters were born into the religion. They were schooled in it from the beginning. Nearly everyone they knew was a Scientologist. Each of the girls was a near clone of one of the parents. Alyssa and Katie were Paul, pale and blonde, but more sharp-featured, with dimpled noses and sculpted cheekbones. Lauren, the middle daughter, was Diane, inheriting her half-Greek mother's olive skin and dark Mediterranean eyes. The girls were bright, inquisitive, and cheerful by nature, but their parents' divorce was an endless, churning, distracting, heartbreaking trauma, and it took a toll. The girls went to Delphi Academy, a private school that uses Hubbard Study Tech. It is largely self-guided. According to Scientology pedagogy, there are three barriers that retard a student's progress. The first is lack of mass. This principle was derived from Alfred Korzybski's observation that the word and the object that it names are not the same thing. If the student is studying tractors, for instance, it is best to have a real tractor in front of him. The absence of the actual object is disorienting to the student. It makes him feel physiologically condensed, Hubbard writes. Actually makes him feel squashed, makes him feel bent, sort of spinny, sort of dead, bored, exasperated. Photographs of the object can help, or motion pictures, as they are a sort of promise of hope of the mass. But they are not an adequate substitute for the tractor under study. The result for the student is that he becomes dizzy, he'll have headaches, his stomach gets upset, his eyes will hurt, and he's going to wind up with a face that feels squashed. Illness and even suicide may be the expected result. Hubbard's Study Tech remedies the problem by using clay or Play-Doh for the student to make replicas of the object. The second principle is too steep a gradient, which Hubbard describes as the difficulty a student encounters when he makes a leap he's not prepared for. It is a sort of a confusion or a reelingness that goes with this one, Hubbard writes. His solution is to go back to the point where the student fully understands the subject, then break the material into bite-sized pieces. The undefined word, the third and most important principle, occurs when the student tries to absorb material while bypassing the definition of the words employed. The only reason a person gives up a study or becomes confused or unable to learn is because he has gone past a word that was not understood, Hubbard emphasizes in one of his chiding technical bulletins. Words sometimes have different or more than one meaning. A misunderstood word gives one a distinctly blank feeling or a washed-out feeling, Hubbard writes. A not-there feeling and a sort of an hysteria that will follow in the back of that. The solution is to have a large dictionary at hand, preferably one with lots of pictures in it. All Scientology texts contain glossaries for specialized Scientology terms. The need to understand the meaning of words, Hubbard writes, is a sweepingly fantastic discovery in the field of education, and don't neglect it. These last two principles are fundamental to the induction of Scientology itself. Because the Church asserts that everything Hubbard wrote or spoke is inarguably true, whatever you don't understand or accept is your fault. The solution is to go back and study the words and approach the material in a more deliberate fashion. Eventually, you'll get it. Then you can move on. Lauren loved her teacher at Delphi, but the Hubbard method placed the responsibility of learning almost entirely on the student. For Lauren, her parents' tumultuous divorce was a crushing distraction. It seemed to her that no one was paying attention to her, either at home or at school. She was illiterate until she was 11. She couldn't read or write her own name. Second-generation Scientologists are typically far more at home with the language and culture of the Church than their parents are, and yet they may find themselves a little lost when trying to deal with an uncomprehending society. The first time Alyssa noticed that she was doing something different from most people was when she performed a contact assist. Scientology preaches that if you repeatedly touch a fresh wound to the object that caused the injury and silently concentrate, the pain lessens and the sense of trauma fades. If a Scientologist sees a person close his hand in a door, for instance, a church manual instructs the Scientologist to have him go back and, with his injured hand, touch the exact spot on the same door, duplicating the same motions that occurred at the time of the injury. There are other kinds of assists that will awaken an unconscious person, eliminate boils, reduce earaches and back pain, and make a drunk sober. Instead of crying when she hurt herself, Alyssa would quietly redo the action over and over until she had drained it of its sting. She noticed that non-Scientologists had no idea what she was doing. She was also surprised when she went to a friend's house for dinner and the family said grace before the meal. It took her a second to realize what they were doing. In her opinion, God plays a negligible role in Scientology. I mean, there's a spot for it, but it's sort of a blank spot. So whenever her friends began to pray, I would bow my head and let them have their ceremony. Paul was also scarred by the divorce, although, as would often be the case for him, he would mine the experience for his work. He created a television series, Family Law, that was based to some extent on his divorce from Diane. He always found more solace and meaning in his work than he did in his family. Each year he grew more successful, but the gap between him and his daughters grew wider. They knew him better as a writer than as a father, and they would puzzle over the fact that he was so cool to them when his scripts were often full of emotion. Paul felt guilty about not spending time with the girls, so he would arrange to bring them to the set and assign them some small task. Alyssa got to do nearly every job in the industry, from wardrobe to production assistant. She received a Directors Guild card in Canada by the time she was 15. In 1991, Haggis went to a 4th of July party at the home of some Scientologist friends. He met a striking actress there named Deborah Renard. She had grown up in Scientology. In her early 20s, she had studied acting at the Beverly Hills Playhouse and had fallen under the influence of Milton Katselas, the legendary acting teacher and Hubbard's former collaborator. They became lovers. Milton was spellbinding, but he was 27 years older than Deborah, and their relationship was an exhausting roller coaster ride. They stayed together for 6 years. When Paul met her, Deborah and Milton had recently broken up. She was a successful actress with a recurring role in the long-running television series Dallas as J.R. Ewing's loyal but always unattainable secretary. Paul was still going through his epic divorce. Early in his relationship with Deborah, Paul admitted that he was having a spiritual crisis. He said he'd raced up to the top of the bridge on faith, but he hadn't gotten what he expected. "I don't believe I'm a spiritual being. I actually am what you see," Paul told her. Deborah advised him to get more auditing. Personally, she was having breakthroughs that led her to discover past lives. Images floated through her mind, and she realized, "That's not here. I'm not in my body. I'm in another place." She might be confronting what the church calls a contra-survival action, like the time I clobbered Paul or threw something at him. She would look for an earlier similar in her life. Suddenly she would see herself in England in the 19th century. It was a fleeting glimpse at what I was doing then, clobbering husbands. But when she examined these kindred moments in her current existence and past ones, the emotional charge would dissipate. Paul would say, "Don't you think you're making this up?" At first she thought he might be right, but then she wondered if that really mattered. She felt she was getting better, so who cared whether they were memories or fantasies? As an actor, she went through an analogous process when working on a scene. She would grab hold of a feeling from who knows where. It felt real. It helped her get into the role. As long as the process worked, why quibble? Deborah made sure Paul showed up at the annual gala and became involved in Scientology charitable organizations. Over the years, Haggis spent about $100,000 on courses and auditing, and an equal amount on various Scientology initiatives. This figure doesn't include the money that Diane gave to the church while she was married to Paul. Haggis also gave $250,000 to the International Association of Scientologists, a fund set up to protect and promote the church. Deborah spent about $150,000 on coursework of her own. Paul and Deborah held a fundraiser in their home that raised $200,000 for a new Scientology building in Nashville, and they contributed an additional $10,000 from their own pocket. The demands for money, regging it's called in Scientology because the calls come from the registrar's office, never stopped. Paul gave them money just to keep them from calling. Chapter 7. The Future is Ours. Now that he was firmly in control of the church, Miscavige sought to restore the image of Scientology. The 1980s had been a devastating period for the church's reputation, with Hubbard's disappearance and eventual death, the high-profile lawsuits, and the avalanche of embarrassing publicity. Miscavige hired Hill and Knowlton, the oldest and largest public relations firm in the world, to oversee a national campaign. The legendarily slick worldwide chairman of Hill and Knowlton, Robert Keith Gray, specialized in rehabilitating disgraced dictators, arms dealers, and governments with appalling human rights records. As representatives of the government of Kuwait, Hill and Knowlton had been partly responsible for selling the Persian Gulf War to the American people. One of the company's tactics was to provide the testimony of a 15-year-old girl, Nayira, to a human rights committee in the U.S. House of Representatives in October 1990. Nayira described herself as an ordinary Kuwaiti who had volunteered in a hospital. She tearfully told the House members of watching Iraqi soldiers storm into the prenatal unit. "They took the babies out of the incubators, took the incubators, and left the babies on the cold floor to die," she said. The incident could never be confirmed, and the girl turned out to be the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States and had never volunteered at the hospital. The propaganda operation was, at the time, the most expensive and sophisticated public relations campaign ever run in the United States by a foreign government. Gray had also worked closely with the Reagan campaign. He regaled the Scientologists with his ability to take a mindless actor and turn him into the Teflon president. Hill and Knowlton went to work for the church, putting out phony news stories, often in the form of video news releases made to look like actual reports rather than advertisements. The church began supporting high-profile causes, such as Ted Turner's Goodwill Games, thereby associating itself with other well-known corporate sponsors such as Sony and Pepsi. There were full-page ads in news magazines touting the church's philosophy and cable television ads promoting Scientology books and Dianetics seminars. Then, in May 1991, came one of the greatest public relations catastrophes in the church's history. Time magazine published a scathing cover story titled "Scientology, the Thriving Cult of Greed and Power," by investigative reporter Richard Behar. The expose revealed that just one of the religion's many entities, the Church of Spiritual Technology, had taken in $500 million in 1987 alone. Hundreds of millions of dollars from the parent organization were buried in secret accounts in Liechtenstein, Switzerland, and Cyprus. Many of the personalities linked with the church were savaged in the article. Hubbard himself was described as part storyteller, part flimflam man. The Feshbach brothers were the terrors of the stock exchanges, who spread false information about companies in order to drive down their valuations. Behar quoted a former church executive as saying that John Travolta stayed in the church only because he was worried that details of his sex life would be made public if he left. The article asserted that Miscavige made frequent jokes about Travolta's allegedly promiscuous homosexual behavior. When Behar queried Travolta's attorney for the Star's comment, he was told that such questions were bizarre. 2 weeks later, Travolta announced that he was getting married to actress Kelly Preston, a fellow Scientologist, Behar wrote. Those who criticize the church, journalists, doctors, lawyers, and even judges, often find themselves engulfed in litigation, stalked by private eyes, framed for fictional crimes, beaten up, or threatened by death, Behar noted. He accused the Justice Department of failing to back the IRS and the FBI in bringing a racketeering suit against the church because it was unwilling to spend the money required to take the organization on. He quoted Cynthia Kisser, head of the Cult Awareness Network in Chicago. "Scientology is quite likely the most ruthless, the most classically terroristic, the most litigious, and the most lucrative cult the country has ever seen." After the Time article appeared, Miscavige was invited to appear on ABC's Nightline, a highly prestigious news show, to defend the image of the church. He had never been interviewed in his life. He rehearsed for months, as much as 4 hours per day, with Rathbun and Rinder. He would prod them to ask him questions, then complain that they didn't sound like Ted Koppel, the show's courtly but incisive host. Miscavige would ask himself the questions in what he thought was Koppel's voice, then respond with a hypothetical answer. He sorted through what seemed to his aides an endless number of wardrobe choices before settling on a blue suit with a purple tie and a handkerchief in his breast pocket. Finally, on Valentine's Day, 1992, he went to New York, where the show would be broadcast live. The interview was preceded by a 15-minute report by Forrest Sawyer about Scientology's claims and controversies. "The church says it now has centers in over 70 countries, with more on the way," Sawyer said. Heber Jentsch, the president of the Church of Scientology International, was featured, claiming a membership of 8 million people. Sawyer also interviewed defectors who talked about their families being ripped apart or being bilked of tens of thousands of dollars. Richard Behar, the Time reporter, recounted how Scientology's private investigators had obtained his phone records. Vicky Aznarán, a former high official in the church who was then suing the church, told Sawyer that Miscavige ordered attacks on those he considered troublemakers. Have them, their homes, broken into. Have them beaten. Have things stolen from them. Slash their tires. Break their car windows. Whatever. Koppel allowed Miscavige to respond to the Sawyer report. Every single detractor on there is a part of a religious hate group called Cult Awareness Network and their sister group called American Family Foundation, Miscavige said. It's the same as the KKK would be with blacks. He seemed completely at ease. You realize there's a little bit of a problem getting people to talk critically about Scientology because, quite frankly, they're scared, Koppel observed. Oh, no, 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 no. I'm telling you, people are scared, Koppel insisted. Let's not give the American public the wrong impression, said Miscavige. The person getting harassed is myself and the church. Koppel then lobbed what seemed like an easy question for a man who had spent so much time preparing for this encounter. See if you can explain to me why I would want to be a Scientologist. Because you care about yourself and life itself, Miscavige said eagerly. He gave the example of communication skills. This is something that major breakthroughs exist in Scientology, being able to communicate in the world around you, he said. There's an actual formula for communication which can be understood. You can drill on this formula. So far in life, I haven't had a whole lot of trouble communicating, Koppel drolly noted. What in your life do you feel is not right, that you would like to help? Miscavige asked. It was a classic Scientology technique to find a subject's ruin, the thing that was blocking his access to happiness. I feel perfectly comfortable with my life, Koppel replied. Miscavige switched tactics. Let's look at it this way, then. What Scientology does. If you look out across the world today, you could say that if you take a person who's healthy, doing well, like yourself, you'd say that person is normal, not a crazy, not somebody who is psychotic. You look at a wall, and they call it an elephant, he said, extemporizing. And you can see people below that, crazy people, criminals, that I think society in general will look at and say that breed of person hasn't something quite right because they're not up to this level of personality. What we are trying to do in Scientology is take somebody from this higher level and move them up to greater ability. What about the folks down there? We don't ignore them. My point is, Scientology is there to make the able more able. Another way of saying that is, you're interested in folks who've got money. Miscavige objected, claiming that the money in the church goes to good causes. We are the largest social reform group in the world, he said, adding that if a person stays in Scientology long enough, he'll have plenty of money. Then he referenced Sawyer's report again. The one girl there that was complaining about it, a girl named Vicky Asnerin, which, by the way, this is a girl who was kicked out for trying to bring criminals into the church, something she didn't mention. You say a girl. I think we're talking about a grown woman, right? A grown woman, excuse me, Miscavige said. She violated the mores and codes of the group. Either you have made an accurate charge against someone, or what a number of the pieces written about Scientology suggest is that when you have a critic before you, you destroy those people. That's easy to say, you smear them. That's easy for the person to say, but she's the one on that program smearing me. As for Richard Behar, the Time reporter, Miscavige remarked, the man was on record on two occasions attempting to get Scientologists kidnapped. That is an illegal act. The hour had ended, but Miscavige had just made another unsupported allegation. Koppel decided to extend the show a few minutes, but it went on another half hour without any commercial breaks. He asked Miscavige to explain what he meant about Behar. Some people had called him up and he was telling them to kidnap Scientologists out, Miscavige said. Now, kidnapping, as you well know, is a federal crime, Koppel observed. So why didn't you bring charges against him?
He didn't succeed, Miscavige said.
Ted, you're missing the point.
There is such a thing as attempted rape, attempted murder, attempted kidnapping. It's also a crime.
I think you're really missing the issue, Ted, because my point is this. That man represents himself as an objective reporter. Here he is on record a full 3 years before he wrote this article, stating that he felt Scientologists should be kidnapped to change their religion.
Second of all, Miscavige continued, let's look at this article, and let's not fool ourselves. It wasn't an objective piece. It was done at the behest of Eli Lilly, the pharmaceutical manufacturer. They were upset because of the damage we had caused to their killer drug, Prozac.
I'm sure you have evidence of that, Koppel said. You have affidavits?
Let me tell you what else I have.
You have affidavits?
From them? Of course not. You think they'd admit it? Miscavige said.
We put in a call to Eli Lilly. Their response was, we can neither confirm nor deny.
Footnote.
Behar says that a private investigator posing as a distraught parent called him and begged for help with a child who had gone into Scientology. Behar had referred the caller to the Cult Awareness Network. He says he never advised kidnapping. The private investigator taped the conversation, and Behar's attorney subpoenaed the tape for his defense in the lawsuit brought by the church. End footnote. In Sawyer's report, there was a brief clip of Hubbard telling his followers, I was up in the Van Allen belt. This is factual, and I don't know why they're scared of the Van Allen belt, because it's simply hot. You'd be surprised how warm space is.
Koppel observed, When I hear a man talking about having been taken out to the Van Allen space radiation belt, or spaceships that were essentially the same thing as the DC-8, I've got to tell you, I mean, if we're talking about this man's credibility, that certainly raises some questions in my mind.
Miscavige said that Hubbard's quote had been taken out of context.
Take a minute, if you would, and see if you can put it into context for us so that it does not sound ridiculous, Koppel said.
Okay, said Miscavige. I want you to take the Catholic Church and take right now and explain to me to make sense that the Virgin Mary was a virgin, scientifically impossible, unless we're talking about something.
He trailed off, then said,
Okay, I'll be like you. I'll be the cynic. If we're talking about artificial insemination, how could that be? If you're talking about going to heaven, except we have a space shuttle going out there, we have the Apollo going out there, you do that. I'm not here.
He was obviously confused and uncomfortable.
You were a Catholic as a child, right?
Koppel asked helpfully.
Yeah.
So you know full well that those issues are questions of faith.
Miscavige wouldn't accept the life raft that Koppel offered him. Scientology is sold as an entirely rational approach to understanding and mastering existence.
No,
Miscavige replied. Talk about the Van Allen belt or whatever, that forms no part of current Scientology, none whatsoever.
But what did he mean when he was talking about it?
Quite frankly, this tape here, he's talking about the origins of the universe, and I think you're going to find that in any religion. And I think you can make the same mockery of it. I think it's offensive.
I'm not mocking it. I'm asking you a question, Koppel replied. You turn it around and ask me about Catholicism. I say we're talking about areas of faith.
Well, it's not even a matter of faith, Miscavige insisted, because Scientology is about you, yourself, and what you do. You're bringing up something that isn't part of current Scientology, that isn't something that Scientologists study, that is part of some tape taken from I have no idea, and asking me about it and asking me to put it in context. That I can't do.
Later, Miscavige told Koppel that he had never heard the Hubbard tape before. It was a part of a lecture Hubbard gave in 1963 in which he talked about the between lives period when Thetans are transported to Venus to have their memories erased.
After the show, Miscavige returned to the green room
where Rinder, Rathbun, and Norman Starkey, another executive, were waiting.
"How'd I do?" he asked.
"Gee, sir, you kicked ass," one of the men said.
"It was a home run," Rathbun assured him.
"Really?" Miscavige asked doubtfully.
"Jesus Christ, I was just there, and I don't know, the guy was pissing me off so much."
Koppel won an Emmy for that show. Miscavige took credit for it, saying, "I got Ted the Emmy." He even had a replica of an Emmy made and placed in the officers' lounge at Gold Base. But he never went on television again. The Time story was a turning point in the church's history. The embarrassment for Scientology celebrities undercut the church's strategy of making the religion appear to be a spiritual refuge for the show business elite. One of the chief appeals of the religion to prospective recruits was the perceived network that Scientology provided its members, especially in Hollywood, awarding them an advantage in a ruthlessly competitive industry. With the Time article, affiliation with the church became an embarrassing liability. Tom Cruise was one of the stars who appeared to be backing away from Scientology. Footnote: Cruise, through his attorney, denies that he ever retreated from his commitment to Scientology. End footnote. He stopped moving up the bridge. He and Nicole adopted two children, Isabella and Connor, and began spending more time in Sydney, Kidman's hometown, where she could be close to her family. He hired a powerful publicist, Pat Kingsley, who was able to enforce rigid control over the content of the interviews the star granted. Although his affiliation with Scientology was generally known, there was no more fuel for the media mill. He seemed to be putting as much distance between himself and the church as possible. The church began to plot its counterattack. The Cult Awareness Network, besieged by more than 50 lawsuits brought by Scientologists, went bankrupt in 1996. An individual Scientologist purchased its name and assets at auction. Soon after that, the reorganized Cult Awareness Network sent out a brochure lauding the Church of Scientology for its efforts to increase happiness and improve conditions for oneself and others. The church also began a $3 million campaign against Time, placing full-page ads every day in USA Today for 12 weeks, charging that the magazine had supported Adolf Hitler, for instance, by naming him the 1938 Man of the Year because of his dominance in European affairs. A lengthy supplement was placed in USA Today titled "The Story That Time Couldn't Tell, Who Really Controls the News at Time, and Why?", in which the church claimed that Time was actually under the sway of the pharmaceutical industry, specifically Eli Lilly and Company, the maker of Prozac. The church had charged that Prozac caused people to commit mass murder and suicide. The Time article was the drug company's revenge, the church alleged. Footnote: a spokesperson for Time categorically denied this charge. End footnote. Rathbun directed the ferocious legal assault on Time and oversaw the team of private detectives probing into Bahar's private life. The church, employing what was reported to be an annual litigation budget of $20 million, and a team of more than 100 lawyers to handle the suits already in the courts, filed a $416 million libel action against Time Warner, the parent company of the magazine, and Bahar. Because the church is regarded under American law as a public figure, Scientology's lawyers had to prove not only that the magazine's allegations were wrong, but also that Bahar acted with actual malice, a legal term meaning that he knowingly published information he knew to be false or that he recklessly disregarded the facts because he intended to damage the church. Although there was no convincing evidence proving that the facts were wrong or that the reporter was biased, the case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which sustained the district court's initial ruling against the church.
In the process, it cost time more money in defense costs than any other case in its history. Rathbun's strategy followed Hubbard's dictate that the purpose of a lawsuit is to harass and discourage rather than win. Hubbard also wrote, "If attacked on some vulnerable point by anyone or anything or any organization, always find or manufacture enough threat against them to cause them to sue for peace. Don't ever defend. Always attack." He added, "Never agree to an investigation of Scientology. Only agree to an investigation of the attackers." He advised Scientologists, "Start feeding lurid, blood, sex, crime, actual evidence on the attackers to the press. Make it rough, rough on attackers all the way. There has never yet been an attacker who was not reeking with crime. All we had to do was look for it, and murder would come out." These were maxims that Rathbun took as his guidelines. The Time article capsized Miscavige's attempts to break free of the negative associations so many people had with Scientology. But there was an even larger battle underway, one in which the church's very existence was at stake. Its fight with the IRS to regain its tax-exempt status as a bona fide religion, which it had lost in 1967. The government's stance was that the Church of Scientology was in fact a commercial enterprise with virtually incomprehensible financial procedures and a scripturally based hostility to taxation. The IRS had ruled that the church was largely operated to benefit its founder. Miscavige inherited some of that liability when he took over after Hubbard's death. A tax exemption would not only put the imprimatur of the American government on the church as a certified religion, rather than a corrupt, profit-making concern, but it would also provide a substantial amount of immunity from civil suits and the persistent federal criminal investigations. A decision against the tax exemption, on the other hand, would destroy the entire enterprise, because Hubbard had decided in 1973 that the church should not pay its back taxes. 20 years later, the church was $1 billion in arrears, with only $125 million in reserves. The founder had placed Scientology's head on the executioner's block. The war between the church and the IRS had already gone on for more than 2 decades, with both sides waging a campaign of intimidation and espionage. Miscavige accused the Criminal Investigation Division of the IRS of engaging in surveillance of church leaders, wiretaps, and illegal opening of the church's mail. Now the church upped the ante by besieging the IRS with 200 lawsuits on the part of the church and more than 2,300 suits on behalf of individual parishioners in every jurisdiction in the country, overwhelming government lawyers, running up fantastic expenses, and causing an immense amount of havoc inside the IRS. Miscavige boasted that the entire legal budget of the federal agency was exhausted. They didn't even have money to attend the annual American Bar Association Conference of Lawyers, which they were supposed to speak at. The church ran ads against the agency, using the images of beloved celebrities, who were not Scientologists, such as John Wayne and Willie Nelson, who had been audited by the IRS. "All of America loved Lucy," one ad said, over an iconic photo of Lucille Ball, "except the IRS." A $10,000 reward was offered to potential whistleblowers to expose IRS abuses. Private investigators dug into the private lives of IRS officials, going so far as to attend seminars and pose as IRS workers to see who had a drinking problem or might be cheating on a spouse. Stories based on these investigations were promoted by a phony news bureau the church established and also published in the church's Freedom magazine, which Scientologists passed out for free on the steps of the IRS headquarters in Washington. The hatred on both sides for the other was intense. It seemed bizarre that a rather small organization could overmatch the U.S. government, but the harassment campaign was having an effect. Some government workers were getting anonymous calls in the middle of the night or finding that their pets had disappeared. Whether or not these events were part of the Scientology onslaught, they added to the paranoia many in the agency were feeling. Both the church and the IRS faced the challenge of addressing the question of what, exactly, constituted a religion in the eyes of the American government. On the church's side was a body of scholars who had arisen in defense of what were called new religious movements, such as the Hare Krishnas, the Unification Church, and, of course, the Church of Scientology. The term was employed to replace the word cult, because these academics found no reliable way of distinguishing a cult from a religion. They believe that new religious movements are persecuted and ridiculed simply because they are recent and seem exotic. Often, such experts are paid to testify in court on behalf of these organizations. In the courtroom setting, the casual distinctions that many people often make about cults and brainwashing have proven to be difficult to sustain, as the experts pose telling comparisons with the history of mainstream religions, whose practices and rituals have long since been folded into a broad cultural acceptance. The Church of Scientology had decided to enlist such experts following the FBI raids in 1977, which exposed Operation Snow White and created a major crisis in the church. There was a deliberate campaign to provide religious cloaking for the church's activities. A Scientology cross was created. Scientology ministers now appeared wearing Roman collars, and religious scholars were courted. They were given tours and allowed to interview carefully coached church members. Frank K. Flynn, a former Franciscan friar and a graduate of Harvard Divinity School, has testified repeatedly on behalf of Scientology, notably in 1984 when the Church of Scientology, along with Mary Sue Hubbard, sued Gerald Armstrong, the former archivist for the church. Flynn defined religion as a system of beliefs of a spiritual nature. There must be norms for behavior, positive commands and negative prohibitions or taboos, as well as rites and ceremonies, such as initiations, sacraments, prayers, and services for weddings and funerals. By these means, the believers are united into an identifiable community that seeks to live in harmony with what they perceive as the ultimate meaning of life. Flynn argued that Scientology amply fulfilled these requirements, even if it differed in its expression of them from traditional denominations. Like Catholicism, Flynn explained, Scientology is a hierarchical religion. He compared L. Ron Hubbard to the founders of Catholic religious orders, including his own, started by St. Francis of Assisi, whose followers adopted a vow of poverty. Financial disparities within a church are not unusual. Within the hierarchy of Catholicism, for instance, bishops often enjoy a mansion, limousines, servants, and housekeepers. The papacy itself maintains thousands of people on its staff, including the Swiss guards who protect the Pope, and an entire order of nuns dedicated to being housekeepers for the papal apartments. The Catholic Church also maintains houses of rehabilitation, like the RPF, for errant priests hoping to reform themselves. Flynn saw the RPF as being entirely voluntary and even tame compared to what he experienced as a friar in the Franciscan order. He willingly submitted to the religious practice of flagellation on Fridays, whipping his legs and back in emulation of the suffering of Jesus before his crucifixion. Flynn also spent several hours a day doing manual labor. As a member of a mendicant order, he owned no material possessions at all, not even the robe he wore. Low wages and humble work were essential to his spiritual commitment. There is a place for a supreme being in Scientology, In Hubbard's Eight Dynamics, it's at the top. But the God idea plays a diminished role compared to many religions. On the other hand, some religions worship objects, stones or icons or mandalas, rather than a deity. Scientologists don't pray, but then neither do Buddhists. The idea of salvation, so central to Christianity, is not so different from Hubbard's assertion that the fundamental law of the universe is the urge to survive. Flynn compared the Scientology distinction between pre-clear and clear to Buddhist notions of entanglement and enlightenment, or Christian doctrines of sin and grace. The Scientology creed that humans are thetans simply means we are beings with immortal souls, which no Christian would argue with. One of Flynn's most interesting and contested points had to do with hagiography, by which he meant attributing extraordinary powers, such as clairvoyance, visions of God or angels, or the ability to perform miracles, to the charismatic founders of a religion. He pointed to the virgin birth of Jesus, the ability of the Buddha to transmigrate his soul into the heavens, or Moses bringing manna to the people of Israel. Such legends are useful in that they bolster the faith of a community, Flynn said. The glaring discrepancies in Hubbard's biography should be seen in the light of the fact that any religion tends to make its founder into something more than human. Flynn was asked to testify about a policy Hubbard had written in 1965 titled Fair Game Law, in which he laid down the rules for dealing with suppressive persons. That category includes non-Scientologists who are hostile to the church, apostates, and defectors, as well as their spouses, family members, and close friends. A truly suppressive person or group has no rights of any kind, Hubbard wrote. Such enemies, he said, may be tricked, lied to, or destroyed. In 1965, he wrote another policy letter ambiguously stating, "The practice of declaring people fair game will cease. Fair game may not appear on any ethics order. It causes bad public relations. The new ruling does not cancel any policy on the treatment or handling of an SP." The supposed revocation of fair game took place before Operation Snow White, the harassment of Paulette Cooper and other journalists, the persecution of defectors, and many other actions undertaken by church insiders that were done in the spirit, if not the name, of the original policy. Almost all religious movements in their very early phase tend to be harsh, Flynn reminded the court. He contended that they tend to evolve and become more lenient over time. As for disconnection, he declared that it was functionally equivalent to other types of religious exclusions, such as shunning of non-believers among Mennonites and the Amish. In the book of Leviticus, for instance, which is part of the Torah and the Old Testament of the Christian Bible, idolaters and those who have strayed from the faith were to be stoned to death. That practice has disappeared. Instead, Orthodox Jews will sit Shiva for the non-believer, treating him as if he is already dead. So this kind of phenomenon is not peculiar to Scientology, Flynn concluded. The implication underlying Flynn's testimony was that Scientology is a new religion that is reinventing old religious norms. Whatever abuses it may be committing are errors of youthful exuberance, and in any case they are pale imitators of the practices once employed by the mainstream religions that judges and jurors were likely to be members of. In the 1990s, Flynn had interviewed several Scientologists who were doing RPF in Los Angeles. Their quarters didn't look any worse than his cell in the monastery, where he slept on a straw bed on a board. He asked if they were free to go. They told him they were, but they wanted to stay and do penance. Flynn admits to having been a cut-up when he was in the order, and he felt out of place. "I was an Irishman in a sea of Germans." He would be sent out to dig the potato field as punishment for his misbehavior. However, when he finally decided to leave his order, instead of being incarcerated or given a freeloader tab, he was given a dispensation releasing him from his vows. He never felt the need to escape. He took off his robe, put on civilian clothes, and walked away. His spiritual advisor gave him $500 to help him out. He was never punished or fined or made to disconnect from anyone. In truth, the IRS was ill-equipped to make a case in court that Scientology, or any other creed, was not a religion. Moreover, the commissioner of the IRS, Fred T. Goldberg, Jr., had to balance the longing on the part of some of his executives to destroy the church against the need to keep his resources, both human and financial, from being sucked into the black hole that Scientology had created. One afternoon in Washington, in October 1991, Miscavige and Rathbun were having lunch at the Bombay Club, a swank Indian restaurant near the White House. Miscavige was fed up with the stalemate, which looked as if it could go on forever in an endless stream of billable hours to the church's attorneys. At the lunch, Miscavige announced to Gerald Pfeffer, one of their lawyers, "Marty and I are just going to bypass you entirely. We're going to see Fred." Pfeffer laughed at the thought that Miscavige would talk directly to the commissioner. "I'm not joking," Miscavige said. "Marty, do you want to go?" The two men hailed a cab after lunch and went to 1111 Constitution Avenue, the IRS headquarters, and announced to the security officer that they wanted to see the commissioner. "Is he expecting you?" "No, but if you phone him on the intercom and tell him we are from the Church of Scientology, I'm sure he'd love to see us." Within a few moments, several of the commissioner's aides came down to the lobby. Miscavige told them that he wanted to bury the hatchet. He said he knew how much hatred there was on each side, going back for decades, and that an intervention from the top was necessary. An hour later, there was a call in their hotel room saying the commissioner would see them the following week. In that first meeting with Goldberg in a drab government conference room at a giant table, Miscavige, Rathbun, and Heber Jentsch were facing about a dozen upper-level government bureaucrats, including the commissioner. The level of distrust between the negotiating parties was extreme, made even greater for the IRS representatives who knew that Scientologists had stolen documents and wiretapped meetings in that very building. Both sides had an incentive to bring the hostilities to an end, however. Miscavige and Rathbun made their carefully rehearsed presentation. Miscavige recited a litany of examples in which he felt the IRS had singled out Scientology for unfair treatment. "Am I lying?" he would turn and ask Rathbun theatrically. Rathbun had a briefcase stuffed with documents obtained from the 2300 Freedom of Information Act lawsuits the church had filed, or the countless public records that the church had combed through. Among the many internal memos the Scientologists had gathered was one they called the Final Solution document. It was the minutes of a meeting in 1974 of several top IRS executives who were trying to define religion in a manner that excluded Scientology but not other faiths. Miscavige made it clear that the barrage of lawsuits lodged against the IRS would come to an immediate halt if the church got what it wanted, which was an unqualified exemption for all of its activities. When Miscavige finished his presentation, Goldberg called for a break, but he signaled to Rathbun to hang back. Goldberg asked him privately if the government settled, would Scientology also turn off the personal attacks in Freedom magazine? "Like a faucet," Rathbun told him. Goldberg appointed his deputy commissioner, John Burke, who had no history with the conflict, to oversee a lengthy review of Scientology's finances and practices. That process went on for 2 years. During that time, Rathbun and Miscavige commuted to Washington nearly every week toting banker's boxes stuffed with responses to the government's queries. 200 Scientologists in Los Angeles and New York were mobilized to go through the books of the church's tangled bureaucracy. The odds against success were high. The courts had repeatedly sided with the IRS's assertion that the Church of Scientology was a commercial enterprise. Miscavige and Rathbun were very much aware that the future of Scientology, if there was one, awaited the result of the IRS probe. Either the panel would rule against them, in which case the church's tax liability for the previous two decades would destroy it, or they would fall under the gracious protection of the Freedom of Religion Clause of the First Amendment, in which case the Church of Scientology and all its practices would be sheltered by the U.S. Constitution. Overshadowing this debate was an incident that renewed the public concern about the dangerousness of totalistic movements. In February 1993, agents for the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms tried to execute a search warrant on a religious commune a few miles east of Waco, Texas, that was run by a Christian apocalyptic group calling themselves the Branch Davidians. The leader, David Koresh, was stockpiling weapons, practicing polygamy, committing statutory rape, and was said to be physically abusing children, although that last charge was never proved. Following a shootout that caused the deaths of 4 government agents and 6 Branch Davidians, the FBI began a siege lasting nearly 2 months and culminating in a catastrophic blaze, broadcast all over the world, that consumed the entire compound. 75 members of the sect died in the final assault, including 25 children. The Waco siege threatened to create a backlash against all new religious movements. On the other hand, the government's handling of the siege and the disastrous finale provoked an international uproar. The hazards of unorthodox belief were clearly displayed, as were the limitations of police forces to understand and deal with fanatical movements. On October 8th, more than 1,000 Scientologists stood and cheered in the Los Angeles sports arena as Miscavige announced, "The war is over." The IRS had settled with the church. Although the terms were secret, they were later leaked to the Wall Street Journal. Instead of the $1 billion bill for back taxes and penalties that the church owed, Scientology agreed to pay just $12.5 million to resolve outstanding disputes. The church also agreed to stop the cascade of lawsuits against the agency. In return, the IRS dropped its investigations. "The magnitude of this is greater than you can imagine," Miscavige said that night at the sports arena. He held up a thick folder of the letters of exemption for every one of the church's 150 American entities. "The victory over the IRS was total," he explained. "It gave Scientology financial advantages that were unusual, perhaps unique among religions in the United States. For instance, schools using Hubbard educational methods received tax exemption. 80% of individual auditing on the part of members was now a tax-deductible expense. 2 Scientology publishing houses that were solely dedicated to turning out Hubbard's books, including his commercial fiction, also gained the tax exemption. The church even gained the power to extend its tax exemption to any of its future branches. They will no longer need to apply to the IRS," Miscavige marveled. "From now on, the church could make its own decisions about which of its activities were exempt." "And what about all those battles and wars still being fought overseas?" Miscavige continued. "Well, there's good news on that front, too." In the past, he observed, foreign governments would say, "You are an American religion. If the IRS doesn't recognize you, why should we?" As part of the settlement, Miscavige revealed, the agency agreed to send notices to every country in the world explaining what Scientology was. "It is very complete and very accurate," Miscavige said of the government brochure. "How do I know? We wrote it." Miscavige summed up the mood in the sports arena. "The future is ours." A month after the church's historic triumph over the IRS in 1993, Rathbun blew. He had come to see Miscavige in a different light during the 2 years they labored over the tax case. The last 6 months of the tax case had been particularly arduous. During that period, he slept only about 4 hours a night. The former athlete was a physical wreck. "I'm only doing this for LRH," he told himself, as he and Miscavige ate dinners together night after night in Washington and trudged back to the Four Seasons in Georgetown. "I'm not going to be this guy's bitch for the rest of my life." No doubt the stress affected Miscavige as well. On the night of his big victory speech in the sports arena, Miscavige showed up for a run-through, but the stage manager, Stefan Castle, was still fiddling with the cues for a complicated laser and pyrotechnic display. According to Castle, Miscavige stormed out into the arena and began to strangle him. Miscavige let him go before any real harm was done, but it was an alarming signal. Amy Scobie, head of the Celebrity Center at the time, also noted that Miscavige's personality began to shift immediately after the IRS decision, becoming more aggressive and hostile. At the party at the Celebrity Center following his speech, Miscavige rudely shoved her aside as he entered. "You just want to get rid of me," she remembers him saying. As far as Rathbun was concerned, it didn't help that Miscavige scarcely acknowledged him in the speech that night. Immediately after the event, reporters from the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times were calling Rathbun to ask about Miscavige's salary, which had been disclosed in the IRS documents. Miscavige and his wife together were making more than $100,000 a year, not an extraordinary figure by the standards of world religious leaders, but quite a contrast to the $30 a week most of the Sea Org members were earning. Miscavige was outraged by the impertinence of the reporters, and Rathbun felt that he was taking it out on him. This was all coming at a time when he had been postponing a final visit to see his father, who was dying of cancer. The St. Petersburg Times published an editorial demanding that Congress investigate the tax exemption decision. Rathbun was sent to Florida to turn around the Times editorial board, who were not at all persuaded by his arguments. Miscavige was furious that Rathbun failed to handle the situation. One evening, Shelley Miscavige called everyone in Rathbun's office together, and in front of his subordinates, she stripped the captain's bars off his uniform. The next day, Rathbun took 4 gold Krugerrands that he had stored in a safe, got on his motorcycle, and drove to Yuma, Arizona. He called his father in Los Angeles from a bar, but a church official answered. He was waiting there with Rathbun's wife, Anne, who begged him to come back. Rathbun felt guilty and conflicted. Drinking steadily, he somehow made it to San Antonio, although he was in frequent communication with church leaders. He finally agreed to call Miscavige, who apologized for his treatment. "You know the kind of pressure I was under. Please just see me," the church leader said, adding that he could be in San Antonio in a matter of hours. "No, I want to see the Alamo," Rathbun told him. They agreed to meet for dinner at the Marriott in New Orleans 2 days later. That evening, Miscavige showed a chastened, vulnerable side of himself that Rathbun had never seen before. According to Rathbun, Miscavige promised to cease acting like a madman. He praised Rathbun for his part in gaining the IRS exemption. "Because you did this," he declared, "you're Kakan." It was a title that Hubbard had come up with in one of his policy letters for a highly productive staff member but in the culture it was understood that such a person would be forgiven for misdeeds in future lifetimes. Hubbard had awarded it to Yvonne Gillam after she died. Rathbun knew that Miscavige was manipulating him, but he was touched nonetheless. As a further reward, Miscavige offered Rathbun the opportunity to go to the Scientology ship, the Free Winds, and cruise the Caribbean for 2 years, doing nothing but studying and training to be an auditor. Rathbun could finally obtain OT-3. It was an offer he couldn't resist.